you were diagnosed with a mitochondrial disease. My next guest, Hazel Curry, is living with a mitochondrial disease, neurogastrointestinal encephalopathy. And she joins me on the line to share with us what life is like. Good evening, Hazel.
Hi there, Maureen. Thanks for having me tonight.
Thank you so much for joining me.
Happy to talk about, I call it MENGI. So that's the acronym because it's a bit of a mouthful. Mitochondrial neurogastrointestinal encephalopathy. It usually is very confusing to people.
It is. You sound like you have a lot of energy. More energy than me.
Well, honestly, I go up and down. Well, as you mentioned about the ATP and mitochondria energy, as you said, like all cells in the human body have mitochondria. So how I describe it to my kids, if this is helpful to people, is mitochondria, they're like the power plant of cells. So they're giving us the energy so we can talk right now or digest food and breathe, et cetera. So when a person has a mitochondria disease, like what I have, the power plants in our cells are just not working properly. So sometimes I call it a massive power outage. So sometimes I'm with my kids and husband, we're hiking, and I'm like, great, going, and all of a sudden I kind of crash. And that's what you mentioned, sort of the ATP and the sort of running out of energy. And mito is that energy.
I was surprised to learn on the Mito Canada website that we make about 2 billion mitochondria every second throughout our lives. Nobody is thinking about mitochondria. Is that a fair enough statement?
I'm not really thinking
about what fuels us. Yeah.
Absolutely. Until I got diagnosed. I got diagnosed in 2020 after probably many years of not misdiagnoses, but just, no one's heard of the disease. I'm still the first and only in British Columbia history. And right now, I don't know of any other Canadians with it. So, and there's 200 of us
in
the whole
world. Right? Wow. And what were your symptoms? Take me back to what you experienced throughout your life.
Yeah, I'd say the biggest moment was right after university in Vancouver. I basically had my heart stop one day, and I had to get a pacemaker. So I was in sort of the cardiology world for a long time. My whole life I was always super skinny, and I still am very slim. And I always had sort of gastro or gut issues. So I'd say those are kind of the big markers. And as time goes on, I was often used to some of those symptoms. But then a chance, I had a scan, a CT scan, and it was a sort of a chance find. And they're like, this is strange. Something doesn't look right in your brain. It doesn't affect my functioning at all. But it kind of led us down the path of genetic testing over the course of a year. And I had blood work sent to California, Texas, and then Finland, which is where they do a lot of genetic testing. And then the final diagnosis was at Columbia University in New York. And that's where they figured out I have this MENGI disease. So, again, super rare. I haven't had a single doctor or anyone who's ever heard of it before outside of researching it when I got it. So I'd say the biggest issue for most MENGI people is the gastro stuff or the gut stuff. People are skinny and things just don't work exactly well. It varies. You know, some people are really, really sick and some people are more mild. So.
And you know, it's a rare disease. And, you know, although there, you said there's nobody else in British Columbia, how about in Canada? Is there anyone?
So right now, I don't know if there was a few people a few years ago, and they've passed away. I haven't been able to find other people, but I have a little Facebook group, and my goal is to find more people around the world. So just like 2 weeks ago, I found someone in Italy. We had a Zoom chat, and I talked to someone in the UK who has it as well, and a few weeks ago, someone in India. So I found 9 people in the world so far of the estimated 200 that are diagnosed.
Oh, I see. Okay. And might there be more people out there who are experiencing some of the progressive symptoms that you experienced that are associated with MENGI, M-N-G-I-E, mitochondrial neurogastrointestinal encephalomyopathy. Yes, it certainly is a mouthful. That are having, they might be struggling with getting the proper diagnosis. They might have
absolutely.
That gastrointestinal motility.
Absolutely. Well, with rare diseases, I think people are misdiagnosed or not diagnosed for years because it looks like something else usually. For Menji, a lot of people, some people it looks like an eating disorder because they're so slim. Some people it looks like Crohn's or colitis, sort of classic gut issues. Some people, they just don't know. And until this sort of the advancing of genetic technology, I'm hopeful as time goes on that there's going to be more and more people not that I want them to be diagnosed, but if they have it, to actually know what they're dealing with and to get the right supports or treatments over time. So I'm hopeful. I'm passionate about trying to help people, wanting to help others with mito disease because it really matters.
Oh, it certainly does. And that, I just want to go dive a little deeper into some of those symptoms that may lead to their thinness. Some of the symptoms that, although Minji varies from case to case, but some people might experience vomiting, nausea, diarrhea, abdominal pain. And none of those are consistent with keeping weight on somebody. And in fact, people can be diagnosed with celiac disease, as you said, anorexia, bulimia, that kind of thing. But so do they seek those treatments and then they don't work and they continue to struggle? And then I would imagine they would get anxiety and depression and...
Sure. I mean, I could see, I could see that being a case for a lot of people. It just doesn't add up exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the other stuff with Menji, some people get sort of tingling or something, drooping eyelids as well. Some people get hearing loss. So any part of your body that where a lot of mito gather, like it's generally more like the gut, brain, eyelids as well. That those are areas that seem to be attacked more with Menji disease.
Mm-hmm. And so that drooping of the eyelids or ptosis, P-T-O-S-I-S.
Exactly, ptosis with a P,
Yes, exactly. That people might have, that might be a symptom in addition to the fatigue, the weakness, as you mentioned, the pins and needles sensation in the hands and feet. This is caused, as I understand it, you probably know better, it's caused by changes or mutations in particular genes. Tell me a little bit about that.
So it is the genetic condition. So your genetic code, there's mutations in it, so in your DNA, and it's the instruction of, it's called the TYMP, which is the gene. So it's just not giving you the right instructions. So it's a genetically inherited disease. So both my parents were carriers. So and if you can imagine, there's only 200 people world with it. And of both my parents be carriers, and then it's autosomal recessive. So then at that point, I would have only had a 25% chance of having the full disease, and I did get it. So
with two parents that were carriers of the gene.
Yeah. So which is, I mean, the rareness is exceptional. So
it certainly is. It certainly is. What was your sense? It's a rare disease, and a lot of people out there are living with rare diseases, and it can be very frustrating because, as you say, you don't really have a community of people that share obesity or diabetes or even, you know, metastatic cancers.
Absolutely.
There's so few people that have this. So what's it like to live with a rare disease?
Well, there's sort of two parts. One is that you're living with having the illness yourself. So just dealing with sort of the ups and downs of all the symptoms or treatments. But it's living in a world where few people understand what you're up against. And even having something like Menji, a mouthful, like it's, how do you even begin to explain to someone what it's about? It's complicated. So it can be lonely. I've read the rare disease, the International Rare Disease Days on February 28th. And of course, every 4 years, it's the 29th. So that was the leap year. So it's part of that sense of rare diseases. But, it's, they say it's few, but many, if that makes sense. So there's few of you with what you have, but there's many people with rare diseases.
We are talking about mitochondrial disease. Mitochondrial disease can affect anyone at any age, and there is no cure. It's extremely rare. The mitochondria are like tiny factories in our cells, responsible for creating more than 90% of the energy we need to survive. I have to say, never before have I spoken to a more energetic advocate who's so passionate about something. In the history of the radio show. Thank you so much, Hazel, for joining me on the line. So obviously there's no cure, but there may be treatments to moderate some of the symptoms. So how is mitochondrial disease diagnosed? How is mitochondrial disease?
How is it treated? Well, yeah, so like you said, there's no cure for it, and there's a few effective treatments, or very few, really. So in my particular case, I take something called a mito cocktail. It sounds more exciting than it is, but it's basically a mix of supplements. A lot of them are just sort of over-the-counter type things, like a mix. It's sort of a scientifically proven mix of sort of vitamin D, B12, a whole bunch of things. So basically to try to strengthen your cell health. And then I know other people with Menji take nutritional supplements. I only take supplements if I've had a really rough gut time, like a Boost or Ensure, that kind of stuff, just to get my stuff up. But part of it, I also need to have 30% more food than everybody else just to keep my basic organs and my body functioning properly. And then another thing I use just to keep healthy is fitness. And as you probably know, when you do fitness, it increases your production of mitochondria. And outside of, obviously, fitness, you can strengthen muscles, your blood pressure, weight management, et cetera. But it does increase your production of mitochondria, which is great. I think it's good for everybody, but it's particularly good for those with mito disease. So I've always been active. I've been really active for about 20 years in particular, and I've had activities. The triathlons, I'm not that good. I like family. Actually, during the pandemic, we did something called pandemic hikes. We went hiking almost every day. So I kind of, like I said, bottom out sometimes with my energy, but that's sort of another treatment I use.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that's why exercise, you know, you don't feel like doing it, but you go out, you do it, and then you feel more energetic and you feel better, whether you have mitochondrial disease or not.
Just
another encouragement for people to get out there, pound the pavement, do some exercise, lift the weights, whatever.
Absolutely. I go to the gym 3 times a week and lift weights as well. But I can't speak for all Menji people. I met a guy a few weeks ago online on Zoom who's Menji, and he's had to have a liver transplant. And I know of a woman, she had to have a stem cell transplant. So there's certainly people I know of who've passed away from it at a young age. Some for the average, and obviously I'm not the average right now, but the average life expectancy is age 37. So the people who have this, who are really unwell or very unwell.
Oh, wow. Yeah. As I mentioned earlier, there is no cure, and which is why it's just so important to have yourself speak about it. Also, the great work that Mito Canada is doing. If you want more information about mitochondrial disease, you can go to mitocanada.org. Lots of information there, lots of ways to get involved, to support. You mentioned that it's lonely sometimes. And I also imagine that it's challenging. Relationships might be challenging as well, because, you know, earlier on in the program, you mentioned you go for a hike and then all of a sudden you peter out and, you know, I can't imagine being halfway up Gross Mountain and just deciding which way do I go?
My kids and my husband, they're like, oh, yeah, mom's done for a little bit. So I used to think before I was diagnosed that I just, you know, my food was off, or I just needed a quick energy boost of like a granola bar or a little bit of juice or something. But in the end, now I know it's actually my mitochondria kind of petering out, like I said before, that power outage in the body. Mm-hmm. I just weed it out. It's not too devastating, but I literally go to zero. Like, I'm hiking, I'm going up hills, I've got great cardio, and all of a sudden I'm down to zero. So I'm like leaning on a tree, taking a deep breath in, and just kind of waiting it out. And then I do have a quick snack, and then it regroups. But yeah, no, you know what, having a rare disease, part of another way I manage it is I like to have a great team. So I've got some great specialists, physiotherapists. I even have a neurophysiotherapist. So I'm working with her to do things to prevent things that haven't happened yet or may happen. There's a dietitian at the clinic, a genetic counselor, RN. So I like the idea of the team approach and trying to learn a little bit of something from everybody that can hopefully help me in this disease.
And you just sound so optimistic and so energetic and so happy and positive, but do you worry? Do you worry about the future?
Sure. I mean, if you read about it, it's called a progressive disease, and I've almost known more people who've died from it than I've found in the world with it. So that can be disarming at times and worrisome. But I do try to focus on that I am doing quite well, and I have the treatments I make work for me, and I take responsibility for my fitness. I eat very healthy. I make all my own food. I make all my own salad dressings. We eat tons of fruit and vegetables. So I always think that must play a good role as well at some point. So I try to take responsibility for as much of it as I can. And some days are crappy. Like last night, I was up 9 times in the night. I had a really bad gut. And then this morning, I was lucky enough. I had a team called the Mighty Menji Spinners. There was a national Mito event called Mito Spin. And I had a team here in Victoria at a spin company. And we had about a dozen family and friends. And we did spinning as a group and then raised money for Mito Canada. So that was fun. The great thing about spinning is you can kind of cheat a little on your bike if you're not feeling
you
good.
You sure can. self-confessed cheater right here in spinning.
Yeah.
And, you know, for people who are living with worry, concern about the future, about perhaps passing it down to their children, or what are some of the strategies you use there? Like, do you use mindfulness? Yeah, I mean, do you do meditation?
I really value my mental health and community. I know the importance of having good people around me. And when I took a photo of the Mito Spin this morning, I smile at the photo. There's all these great people willing to do spinning and to talk about Mito with me, and that's a supportive community. And people are interested in learning about Menji. I mean, it's rare, but that makes it interesting as well. So I hope more people have a chance to learn about it, and I hope at some point there's going to be someone out there who hears this or who gets a strange diagnosis, and maybe they can find there's someone else in the world with it and feel like they can start their own community as well.
Absolutely. Well, Hazel, I hate to end this conversation. It's been delightful, but we're up against the clock. Thank you so much for educating us all about mitochondrial disease, in particular, Menji. And for more information, you can go to mitocanada.org. I encourage you to get involved.